Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 30th of October. Nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. Let me introduce everybody. We have a good panel, great panel today, large group, so let me get to everybody. And then we'll dive right in and talk about the news of the day. Mike Spain is here. He is the associate editor of the Times Union, and it is a great pleasure to have him. He's a
regular Tuesdayite.
No, I was going to say a shadow of your former self because you're sitting on the floor, but that's all right.
That's not quite true. It's just a low chair.
Well, it's...
Now, Alan and I can see eye to eye.
Oh. Nice. Very nice. Good way to start the broadcast, Michael.
Don't make me laugh.
Judy... You can't go downhill from here. I'm down too low.
No, that's true. That's true. Any more downhill and you'll be at the bottom. Judy Patrick is here. She is... Well, she forever was the editor of the Daily Gazette, and now she is the vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association.
Good morning, Joe.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, you can just say New York Press Association.
I know, but I have to get it. I want to give you your due, of course. J.P. Miller is with us. J.P. is the man behind the Empire Report. Good morning, sir.
Morning, Joe.
He's also in front of it.
Yeah. Well, that's true. He's on it. He's there. He is the Empire Report. Jim Ketterer is with us. He is Dean of International Studies at Bard College and Academic Director of the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Glad to be back.
Very nice to have you back. WMC's Alan Chartok is in the house. Good morning, sir.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So, no, that's good. That's good. I'm glad I'm here. It's wonderful.
All right.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
You could almost convince a jury. All right. Now let's go to the fact that you can join us in the show today by writing to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. You see, JP, this is the new Today Show.
Unbelievable.
So they got rid of Megyn Kelly.
This is my first time seeing it.
And
like
now
this.
And now this is the new reimagined Today Show, the third
Looks
hour.
Like the old Today Show.
There's Al and there's Savannah. And the other guy whose
Craig
name
Melvin.
Craig Melvin. And then Jenna Hager-Bush, I think, is going to be the host, right? Is that the word? That's what I believe.
People are hoping for Jenna Hager-Bush.
That's what I read in the Empire Report this morning.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Let's get to business. There's a lot to talk about. Of course, we spoke yesterday about the tragedy in Pittsburgh, and we will continue to talk about this morning. As the city readies itself for the many funerals that'll be taking place, and the president will be visiting the synagogue as well today. And even though the mayor said don't come, but residents in grief-stricken Pittsburgh are preparing for the first of many funerals Tuesday, as well as a visit from the president, who plans to meet with members of the Jewish community. The mayor requested that he postpone the trip until after families bury those killed in Saturday's synagogue shooting. The man accused in the attack, the deadliest on Jews in American history, with 10 people killed, made his first court appearance on Monday, 2 days after the massacre. Robert Bowers, a 46-year-old truck driver, was using a wheelchair because of injuries he incurred in a gun battle with police at the Tree of Life Synagogue in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood of Pittsburgh. He allegedly told authorities upon his arrest that he was seeking to kill Jews. Magistrate Judge Robert Mitchell read the charges against him, including obstruction of exercise of religious beliefs resulting in death. Bowers, dressed in a blue sweatshirt and gray sweatpants, appeared coherent and alert. He said little, answering yes when the judge asked whether he had requested a public defender because he could not afford an attorney. He was being held without bail. So those are the basics. Let us start there. Alan, go ahead.
Well, it's so awful that it's almost non-discussable. I mean, you have this horrible thing that has happened in Pittsburgh. You have a president of the United States who I happen to believe is largely responsible for what happened. Now, he denies it, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the others deny it. But when you spew the kind of hate and divisiveness that this guy does, what do you think is going to happen? There may not be a direct correlation. He didn't tell anybody to pull a trigger. But what he did do from the first day he was elected was to say to people as they pulled out a protester in his audience, beat him up. And that beat him up, as far as I'm concerned, is it puts it on the line. It tells us what we have to know about what he has done to this country. It's just awful.
Jim.
Well, I'm, you know, paying close attention also to the language that's used not only around the Pittsburgh attack and the kind of language that this attacker used, but that we hear more broadly. For instance, the invocation of the name George Soros.
Yes.
And so George Soros, who is the donor of the Open Society Foundations, this is a institution that Bard works very closely with. We have a close relationship with Central European University in Budapest, mm-hmm. which is in the process of being forced out of Budapest. This university was started by George Soros, the end of the Cold War, by a right-wing fascist government, the Orban government. What is it that that government and similar kinds of governments don't like about George Soros when they invoke his name? And it's a pretty thin, very thinly veiled anti-Semitic call out.
Wolf whistle, yes.
Hmm?
Wolf whistle.
yeah, not just a dog whistle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in the wake of Pittsburgh, it bears for all of us to pay closer attention to the ways in which those dog whistles or wolf whistles are being used not only kind of somewhere else in the country, but even in our own communities. Who's using them? Who's saying these sorts of things? Who's supporting them in saying those sorts of things? I really find myself in the end being quite angry about this.
The anti-Semitic attacks that the president invoked during the campaign and even in the first days of his administration and things that he would tweet and say and retweet that were vague enough that he could deny knowing what they meant and yet were seen by many as to be anti-Semitic. And the question is, I mean, to Alan's point, how much of that sows the seeds of this type of hate on top of the platforms that this particular individual was using, where frankly a lot of the information and a lot of the things that had become mainstream because of, again, I say the early days of the administration because a lot of it was Steve Bannon, right? That a lot of that came from. Am I correct on that?
I suppose. I don't think he's the only one, though.
No, he's not the only one. No, but I know there were some. It was
widely believed. Yeah.
Okay. So so we see that being used. That it seems it doesn't seem that far of a stretch to make that connection. Then, and at least to be able to ask the question of, okay, well, what does one have to do with the other?
Well, it's so interesting because their defense inevitably is that the president's daughter and son-in-law are Orthodox Jews.
And his grandchildren.
And his grandchildren. Yeah. And they say that again and again and again. And yet, there are those of us who can understand, as Jim has said, the dog whistle or the wolf whistle, as I have said, understand that this is an attempt, I believe, to have it both ways.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with you that the rhetoric, without this rhetoric, that massacre would not have happened in Pittsburgh. But I also believe that our whole society is responsible in some respects, because whenever we all encounter people who are biased and anti-Semitic, and you really need to stand up to them and have that conversation rather than, oh, I don't want to get into an argument. Mm. I'm going to walk away.
That's always tough.
I think we need to, as a society, really embrace this problem and each and every one of us talk about it and try to educate the people who are biased like this.
I agree. I think we as a society need to be intolerant of this kind of behavior by people and these expressions by people. And we have to constantly call it out. I think that's right. I mean, it'd be easy for one political side to blame President Trump's rhetoric. It certainly hasn't helped, and you know, it's unknown just exactly what motivated this guy in Pittsburgh or this guy down in Florida to send out the bombs. But it's certainly the atmosphere that fostered those kinds of hateful acts. And the amazing thing to me is that just as this is unfolding, the president is complaining that the news media isn't doing its job. Republicans are doing so well in early voting at the polls, and now this bomb stuff happens and the momentum greatly slows. News not talking politics. Very unfortunate. What's going on? I mean, he basically doesn't realize that the news media goes after the news, and this is a horrific news that has just dominated the airwaves and the pages of newspapers and the internet, because it is so important. Even he recognizes that by trying to, go and be a leader and demonstrate his potential to be a leader by going to Pittsburgh.
Well, Mikey, don't you think that's because his numbers are in a precipitous freefall right now? In 1 week, he lost 4 percentage points on his...
Yeah, but he lost it from the highest he's been since he's been in the White House.
Well, yeah. On the other hand, he was doing okay, but now he's not doing okay. It is amazing. You say, well, that may be why he's going out to Pittsburgh, but it also may work against him. I mean, I think there are plenty of people who are just furious when the guy who they blame for having set the tenor of the country is going out there and now pretending in a pious sort of way, that he's there to heal, when he's been pretty obvious and pretty honest about not wanting to heal but to divide.
JP.
Yeah, I certainly think the president deserves a significant amount of blame for the atmosphere that's created in the country. I do also think that the media has turned into really just a 24-hour shouting match on Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, and on Twitter. And a couple weeks ago, I deleted my Twitter app off my phone, and I've never been happier. So I do think that the media shares in the blame. I don't think that they share more in the blame than Trump. I think Trump really, should have the lion's share of the blame, but the media certainly does share in the blame. There's overheated rhetoric every single day, every tweet. And I think the saddest thing is that our country's going through this really tough time, and the media focuses not on the issues and the event, but on Trump's reaction to the event. It's Trump said this, Trump tweeted this. Trump.
I got to disagree. I really have to disagree with you. How you can equate the way the president has behaved to the media? The media's job is to be the critic. It's to be critical and to analyze and report what's going on. I know there are pundits who appear on the cable news channels who have that kind of rhetoric, but the media in general, you can't attribute this to them.
Well, I didn't equate it. I said Trump deserves more blame. But I think that the media environment in this country, when you turn on Fox News and CNN and NBC and MSNBC every single night, is shouting, no, it's the Democrats' fault. No, it's the Republicans' fault.
Well, you're looking at very, very, right. You're looking at the cable news networks that are ideological rather than the media.
Well, look. JP, my dear friend, and you are a dear friend, and I know that. You brought me a yoga block.
Get ready, buddy.
Get ready for the butt.
It's never good when he starts this way.
You are. But there is such a thing as right and wrong here. And wrong is what the president of the United States has done to this country. It's just terrible. And it's a false equivalency to say they're all yelling at each other. When Mike is defending the press, I don't want to even go there. The press is the First Amendment right in this country is sacrosanct as far as I'm concerned. But it is a guy who says that he purposely does this. He admits it. He says it in speeches. He's a bad man.
He certainly does it. And the media... The only person that benefits more from Trump's rancid rhetoric, the only group that benefits more from his rancid rhetoric and his atmosphere that he has created, is the media, who profits on it and focuses incessantly on every single thing he
does. But what is the alternative to that? I mean, I think it becomes a focal point because there is great misunderstanding as to what is happening. For example, the president yesterday tweets early in the morning that once again saying that the press is the enemy of the people, that none of this would have happened if it weren't for the press, and that the media has to stand up to bring this country together. Then, as if planned, retweets an article by Dinesh D'Souza, for God's sakes, and a man who he pardoned earlier this year. My question to you then is, how does that, if the media starts, in your words, and I understand what you're saying, I'm not mocking you on this, but, you know, and the media starts screaming about that, I think it's out of just some sort of incredulous, well, how, why, let's look at this as an hypocrisy.
So what I would say is, if the media's goal is to educate everybody and say these are the news events that are happening and this is how the president is reacting to those, what has happened to that, to Trump and to the media over the first year and a half, is trust in the media is at an all-time low and Trump approval is at an all-time high. So I would say that the media, how they are reacting and how they are interpreting the news, I think that they could better fight Trump by not focusing on every little thing he does, talking about what the issues are.
Attention to his tweets, only his presidential statements from Sanders.
Look, here we have a guy who is, in my opinion—
I don't think I said that.
Well, wait, it sounds like it. Here's what I'm saying.
Oh, man, we're starting to argue just like MSNBC and Fox.
Well, here's what I—okay.
I'm in this room of journalists, just staying quiet.
The good news is we have a break in 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I think this guy is a neo-Nazi. I think he's leading us into a terrible situation. And I think it's false equivalency to say, okay, boys, boys, girls, girls, stop fighting with each other. We have a terrible man here who offers the potential for ending this democracy or this Republican democracy for the people who are going to write us about it. It's a terrible situation. He's a bad man. It's that simple, and people have to call him out.
All right. We're going to pause there, and then we'll have much more on this. I just feel that by the level that we have right now, that we'll probably be able to keep this conversation going till 10:30. We'll be right back. It's the freakiest show. Good morning, and welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is here, Jim Ketterer, J.P. Miller, Judy Patrick, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll further the conversation by reading some of the letters that we've received so far.
But first,
yeah,
I want to ask Jim a question.
Go.
It's the bard guy sitting around the table.
The bard guy.
It's the bard guy.
Yeah. I'm the bard guy. I'm not a bard, but
hello,
I'm the bard
Shakespeare.
Guy.
Yes.
Can you report to us about the potential for the young people turning out at your campus for this election?
Well, I can say that the campus, and I think like many colleges and universities across the country, but I know at Bard, not just in this election, but since my time at Bard, which has been 5 years, puts an enormous amount of work into mobilizing students to either vote in the area around Bard, where you know we have a very competitive congressional race, or to make sure that they get their absentee ballots in. And it is really a major effort to do that. We know that, you know, the numbers of turnout for young people is just not good across time, even in 2016. But there's really a good effort at Bard to do that, and the awareness is raised to a very high level.
So I'm going to ask you a question which is going to get the disdain of everybody else on the panel. Do you think that there is a difference in terms of young people's consciousness on a campus where they pay almost no money or very little money to go to school, as opposed to paying $65,000 a year to Williams or to Bard or to some of these other places where they've been raised in upscale homes where much of this is discussed? I know I only say this because David Gustina, our wonderful colleague, sent out some people from his journalism class to ask young people at the State University whether or not they were going to vote. And he got a lot of, that kind of stuff. Whereas I suspect it's not always so. in these other upscale institutions. Am I stereotyping too much here?
Well, I think maybe you're mischaracterizing all Bard students by saying it's an upscale institution, and to say that all students come from
a similar background. I mean, I got it. I always, every time I say something like that, somebody says we've got a lot
of
feelings.
But it's real. It has, of a SUNY system, I do take a little bit of offense.
I also worked for SUNY for 15 years, so I could talk about that.
You're inferring that children raised in working class families are not interested in the political system.
I am,
system.
In fact, asking. I'm not inferring, because I think there
sometimes
may be a difference. Well, based on the evidence is
anecdotal evidence from a few students you talked to from a journalism class.
I didn't talk to anybody.
Well,
they went out and they talked to people. Anyway, it's a provocative question, I know, and I knew it when I asked it, and I knew I'd get into trouble. Nevertheless, I asked it, and I'm proud of it.
But I do think that it raises the question not just for students, but for people who are feeling overwhelmed in their lives in general. They're having to go from pillar to post, and it's just difficult to kind of make their daily schedules work. Why do we make it so difficult to vote in this country?
Well, why? You know why.
Well, I just asked the question. You know, I mean,
well, you know, yeah. You know,
some
that
some other places do it a little better. I mean, in some states, you can vote early the weekends before the election.
I voted 2 weeks ago.
You don't have to have an excuse to file an absentee ballot in most states. Yeah. In New York, you have to have just a limited number of excuses. And you know, what about people who work during the day? You know, who have children and they have to drop them off at school and daycare, pick them up, get them home at the end of the day, feed them, get them to bed. Some people just have difficulty voting in that window that we call Election Day.
I'm not against that. I think you're exactly right.
And I would also say this. So I've worked on many elections around the world. I've been in many countries that were having their very first free and fair election. And it's always really moving to see people turn out for the first time in their lives for a vote that matters. And it always just reminds me of how so few Americans vote for whatever the reason is. Mm-hmm. Some of it are these logistical issues that we're talking about. Some of it is that many people just feel completely checked out from the system. But
people die for that, right?
I've been in countries where that is happening.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the letters.
Oh, thank you, Joe. Kevin says, none of this would have happened without the widespread use of social media as a vehicle for the antisocial, anti-civil fringe to have a sense of community of like-minded loners who sometimes coalesce but now recently act as lone wolves.
Okay. I completely agree. Social media can be a very toxic environment, and it is unbelievable what people will say. You know, it's interesting when people will say a lot of things on social media, but if you actually talk to them face to face, they back right off.
Hey Jude, how would you solve that problem?
Irresponsible
social media.
So there is the monitoring that Facebook and Twitter are trying to do, but then it's just driving these fanatics into these other streams like this Gab that became incredibly toxic. But you know, we also have the issue of free speech. People should be able to say what they want to say. To a point, you know.
Stop right there. Where's the point?
When they incite violence, I think then it needs to be checked.
Okay, so I've said some pretty provocative things this morning. Have I incited violence?
No. Easy.
Well, don't you see that that's the issue? That there's a fine line here that people have to get.
I don't think it's that fine a line.
I think it's more about civility and society. And I agree with Judy. People face-to-face are not nearly as emboldened as when they sit at a keyboard or punch away on their phone. They feel like they can, you know, they're heroes. They can call people out. They can shame people for whatever they want. But you know, and that's one of the characteristics of social media. It lets you do this sort of, like, feels like it's anonymous, but it isn't. It can be damaging, and we just haven't learned as a society how to manage it and put it in its place. If somebody calls you out on social media, don't take it so personal. There's a lot of wacky people out there.
And I agree with Mike and Judy, and I would say my solution has been to delete it from your phone. You're going to be happier if you do not engage in social media.
Oh, yeah. But we can see that the attacker in Pittsburgh was parroting the language that he's hearing in the broader political narrative, talking about invaders coming across the border, using this language of
regarding the caravan.
The caravan, right. I can't recall if he has been, but I know many others have been saying, back to the George Soros issue, that George Soros is funding these invaders who are coming across this border, that we need to harden the border, and it's a national emergency. You know, this is the language of war. Does it specifically incite violence? Perhaps not, but it certainly draws on language that could inspire someone to join these communities online, and we can see a track record of this particular person having used that exact language.
He called out that Hebrew Immigration Organization,
right,
specifically, and that is the organization that's been around, I mean, for decades. They were the group that would help the Jews that would come in escaping from Nazi Germany during the 30s and get set up. And they have a long history of helping people get established when they come from horrible situations and emigrate to this country. And you know, now anybody who helps people, and, you know, I know, Joe, you'll probably get into it. I mean, the whole idea of just targeting the immigrants, whoever they are, they're not us, it's just become so pervasive.
Yeah. Okay, media versus Trump. I agree with JP that the media could be more savvy about handling Trump, but it's not the media's fault that they have Trump as president to report on. Blaming the media for the division Trump sows feels like shooting the messenger. Also, please put Fox, excluding Shep Smith, in a different category than other news organizations. Thanks always for a great show, and that's from Chris.
Well, boy, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think you certainly can put them in a different box because they're conservative. But, I mean, to JP's earlier point, which I do agree with, when you watch some of the programs, there is an ideology and a
hysteria
and a flippancy that certainly equals now the peddling of now the difference I would maintain that the difference to me is the peddling in conspiracy theories, which Fox seems to be much better at, and certainly much better in the sense that they do it more often, and I don't see that on the other networks as much, although,
but
it's certainly there.
Yeah,
it's certainly
well,
there.
Wait. But don't you think that the people at Fox are bought and paid for? In other words, they're actors who are brought on to Fox in order to say what their owners want. Now, there'll be somebody who writes and says, well, what do you think's going on in MSNBC? That's what they're looking for, too. But I see a hell of a difference between what happens at Fox and happens in these other places.
Well, you know, Fox does encourage and attract people who share the ideology of the philosophy of the Fox network. MSNBC seems to bring on more, getting away from some of their daytime shows where they just seem, as you described, Joe, they do at times bring on a very, very good set of people who are journalists and writers and politicians who talk a lot about the different things. They might argue with them, but it's not as bad, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Okay, fair enough. And returning to the letters then, Russell says, the quote, media is speaking for us. The people who furiously disagree with what the POTUS is saying and doing every single morning, noon, and night. Without the media, we would be living in something approaching a dictatorship. And then we heard from Richard, who said, lying Trump. I agree with Alan. Trump is dangerous. Trump has a bully pulpit. His constant lies are enabled by Fox News. The other media are calling out his speech and behavior. They must continue, and that's Rich from Amherst. Okay. And Carrie Ann says, one grand achievement of the Trump administration is to stoke division. He's a master at it. Just listen to yourselves this morning. And Ted says, Jewish leadership. Where is the national Jewish leadership in calling out the cabinet and administrative staff that are Jewish for not standing up to Trump's behavior? Anybody? Shall I read it again? or not?
I mean, does anybody want to comment?
I think they're silent. Is that correct? I haven't heard.
I think that's the point.
You also look like someone like Netanyahu, I remember in the past, has said there's no greater friend to the Jewish people and to Israel than President Trump. You know, what does Netanyahu say about these recent events? I don't think that he's commented.
I recall that the Israeli government is sending ministerial level representatives, probably already here in the U.S. I think there's a minister of the diaspora or something like that, and they've come. I think it's also noteworthy, this has nothing to do with Israel, but that the Muslim organizations in Pennsylvania have raised a tremendous amount of money in the wake of this. On the question of Netanyahu, though, would Netanyahu have a private conversation with Trump about this? Is that somebody that Trump would actually listen to on this subject? I think it is somebody that Trump would listen to. I'm not sure that Netanyahu would be willing to jeopardize this relationship over this issue.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll go back to letters. When we return, we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Music this morning from Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox, playing at the Mehewi in Great Barrington this Friday, November 2nd. You can find out more by going to mehewi.org. We also have the full playlist of all the music that we've been playing from Postmodern Jukebox this morning at wamc.org/roundtable. We welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org, and we return to the letters now to finish those up before we move on to other topics.
Dan from Fishkill says, good morning, panel. I will listen to the entire discussion, but Alan's opening comments said it all. The leader sets the tone, and the tone is hateful. He will never take responsibility because he has no shame. And then we heard from Carolyn, who said, right on, JP, outrage over Trump isn't the news. The issues are the news. Focus on the facts, not the issues. Oh, I'm so sorry. I misread that. Focus on the facts of the issues, not on Trump's behavior. His tantrums are the shiny objects of the carnival barker that distract the press.
What are we going to do? Ignore the president of the United States when he's a bigot and saying bigoted things? I don't know how you can ignore that. That's part of the responsibility of the media to report full and what's going on.
It's also part of the responsibility of leadership. This guy is the leader, supposedly the most powerful man in the world.
Not so much anymore.
Oh, I don't agree with you. I think when the president of the United States has something to say, it has a humongous audience that is listening to it. With the now disappearance of Angela Merkel, I think there is not a person who is competitive in terms of influence with this president. Anyway, Jamie says the greatest generation. Often we are told that the generation that fought Hitler was the greatest generation. I often wonder how great was a generation that allowed World War II to occur or to fail to realize and act on the wrongs of World War I. Once again, I find the generation closing its eyes and hiding beyond rhetoric they would not believe in if you could only get them to think about it. They are just angry. Why? Because they're going to die? Do they really fight the Second World War to subscribe to Nazi nationalistic ideology? I thought they would be concerned with what history will say about them. I now realize they have no such fear because they plan to write it. And then Caroline says, I'm a citizen of the United States by virtue of having been born here. I am first generation. I retired from the U.S. Navy with over 20 years of service. Do I now need to worry that my citizenship will be stripped from me? Or am I okay because I am white? Can he really roll back provisions of the 14th or any amendment by executive order? Keep up the good work.
Of course, you're referring to the news this morning that the president is considering an executive order that ends the constitutional guarantee that if you're born in the United States, you're entitled to citizenship. I don't know that a president's executive order can supersede Congress, let alone the Constitution.
It will be very interesting to see what
happens. But it's very popular, I'm sure, with his people.
And let's see what happens when it gets to the Supreme Court. with some of his recent designees.
Yeah, but I don't think he's not caring about that right now. This just has everything to do with the elections.
Sure. Exactly right.
That's all going to be sorted out later. I mean, he floated the idea of a 10% tax cut for the middle class. You know, the details to be determined
and
later.
Congress isn't even meeting.
And they're not even
the election.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. You're right. Okay, thank you for that, Caroline. And John says, birthright citizenship. Good morning, panel. While I don't fully agree with the president that the birthright citizenship law should be scrapped completely, I feel it needs revising. It is no secret that plenty of illegal immigrants come over while pregnant and have a child in our nation.
Well, the president will certainly appeal to that person.
Yep. Yes. Right, Mike. So that the child will automatically be considered a citizen, I highly doubt. That loophole was the purpose of the original law. And Joseph says, outrage. Good morning, panel. Amazing how Trump can consider ending the citizenship right of those born here when he is a direct beneficiary of that amendment. His father came here from Germany in an ocean-going caravan, a ship with hundreds of other immigrants, in capital letters. He is the son of an immigrant, first generation, Joseph.
It doesn't matter.
Right, but I think the point of whatever Trump is saying he's going to do is that this would be unlawful immigrants, people who came to the country illegally. If you're to continue the protection, if you're in the country legally, if you have a child, it will certainly be a citizen. Not that I agree with this proposal at all, especially because the discussion is always colored with the idea that we're not going to allow someone to have a baby and then they would be afforded the rights or the benefits of being an American for 85 years, inferring once again that they are going to be on welfare and taking all these free benefits.
When statistics are show the contrary, that immigrants are very productive and contribution to society, and the amount of crime that immigrants commit is far below that we commit who've been here several generations. But it's popular to go after immigrants, and it's right before the election, so this is a good way to do it. I agree with you, Jim.
And yet his numbers went down 4%.
Trump said during an interview with Axios that we're the only country in the world where a person comes in and has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, and it has to end. Many legal scholars, most legal experts, say that his plan and the executive order that would seek to end the right to U.S. citizenship for children born in the United States to non-citizens runs afoul with the Constitution. Whether the move is legal, Trump seemed to welcome the controversy his comments ignited. The White House has been intent on stoking a debate over immigration as a way to motivate Trump's base to turn out for the midterm elections in which Republicans risk losing the House. In recent weeks, he's also repeatedly called attention to the migrant caravan working its way toward the border and U.S.-Mexico border, invoking it as a symbol of what he sees as wrong with the U.S. immigration system and blaming Democrats for a lack of action. He's talking, using the term anchor babies again.
Right. And he's also calling the people coming through Mexico as invaders, and he's sent 5,000 U.S. troops to the border now, even though it's, they're walking, so it's going to take
several weeks
at least before the ones that decide to continue on the trek to get to the border. And then they have the legal right to request request admission to the U.S., and I don't know what happens after that. I guess the troops can keep them from coming in.
just the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. The head of the ACLU's Immigrant Rights Project said the president cannot erase the Constitution with an executive order.
Yeah, and what happened to the man who hated executive orders when he was running for office? Do you remember all the criticism of Obama over that?
Right. I mean, I guess any president could just issue, if you can issue an executive order that supersedes the Constitution, the presidents years ago could have gotten
murder is legal. Right. Go for it.
Or my, you women can't vote anymore.
But I think the phrase also that jumps out at me in that interview from the president, I think, I guess it was
with Axios.
This morning, 85 years of benefits. So that's certainly directed.
That's an actuarial prediction, I believe, yes.
And, of course, overlooks all the many contributions that people make to this country.
Like George Soros. You know?
Yes, right.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, J.P. Miller, Judy Patrick, and Mike Spain. We welcome your thoughts. We'll be back right after this. Can it be now? Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. There's a new poll out this morning from Monmouth University regarding the 19th Congressional District. Of course, this is the one of the most watched congressional races in all the United States of America. In this latest poll, Democratic candidate Antonio Delgado has increased his lead over first-term Congressman John Faso. According to the poll, 49% to 44% over Faso among likely voters using Monmouth's standard midterm turnout model. Another 3% support a third party. I believe the breakdown is 2% for Diane Neal, 1% for the Green Party candidate, and 4% in this poll are undecided. This is where I don't understand, and Mike, perhaps you can help me here. The race stands at 51% for Delgado and 43% for Faso using a model that incorporates a turnout surge in Democratic precincts similar to the turnout dynamic seen in special elections held over the past year. What the hell does that mean?
Turnout, estimating, knowing how the people you ask respond is one thing, and then estimating how many of those people are going to turn out and trying to speculate and use math to figure out which of those are going to turn out and in what percentages. That's, you know, they're just trying to factor in the many, many unknowns and come as close as they can.
So let me just remind everybody that was it Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez? She was how many points? 15 points behind, and there was a 50% change.
But what was a major factor in that election or in that primary?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Was turnout? I mean, it was extraordinary.
It was a special election, and this, although turnout,
so is that using the Democratic surge model?
I think it's fair to put in the Democratic surge model. If you look historically, incumbent presidents do very poorly in their first off-term election. Donald Trump is going to, I think, perform a lot worse than Obama and Clinton did in their first terms.
And they didn't do well.
Yeah. Right. Obama lost, I think, 60 seats. Clinton, I think, lost 50 seats. So I think that Trump could certainly do worse than that.
Well, but he's out every night. He's got 11 more of these things, but I think he's hurting himself with them.
He's making him the issue on the ballot, not the individual candidates, which may hurt or help. Who knows?
And the other thing about this district is it went twice for Obama. Faso's district went twice for Obama and once for Trump. So it is truly a swing district. And swing district, you would have to imagine, will go against the incumbent president this time.
So what does it say? So not to read too much into this, although I want to read too much into this, which is Delgado, according to this poll, has a 54% to 38% advantage among female voters in the district.
Huge.
If we extrapolate that across the country in other, let's say, swing districts, what would that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's an expectation that more women will turn out, perhaps. Maybe that's part of that extrapolation they were talking about or you were referencing in describing it.
But do we know about turnout? We know what the returns are in the polls. I have to be very careful here. So in other words, we know that potential female voters are saying we prefer the Democrats by huge numbers. But what we don't know is who actually comes to the poll and turns out.
You know, I got polled last week on my landline. I got a call. It was for my assembly district, clearly that race. And they wanted to know on a scale of 1 to 10 how likely I was to vote. So I had to put a number on it. And they wanted, you know, whether I was male or female. They wanted to know how old I was. And they asked a lot of interesting questions about abortion, about government jobs. They didn't ask anything about health care, which I thought was really interesting because I thought that was the hot issue among...
But state assembly, I don't know if health care is so much an issue.
Didn't think jobs or abortion was either.
Well, abortion is an issue in the state legislature. I mean, there's a Women's Health Act that is highly debated by state lawmakers.
So
I hang up on the pulses when they call me, and I do because.
Oh, why don't you just give them disinformation?
Yeah, no, I hang up on them because I don't. I know enough about polling to know that there's an awful lot of phony polls out there, right. And there are these so-called push polls yeah. In which they say, "Do you know how John Fassel feels about abortion?" or something like that.
Well, the famous one was John McCain in South Carolina, mm-hmm. where they said, "Does it bother you that John McCain has a multiracial child?" Yeah. Making it sound like he had an affair or something, and he had an adopted child who was African American. I mean, you know.
It doesn't bother you.
It's also tougher to predict turnout in New York's 19th congressional district and all of New York districts because we don't have early voting. In other states, you know, we're one of 13 states that doesn't have early voting. And when you have early voting, you can go to the rolls and see, okay, 50% of the Democrats have voted, 48% of the Republicans voted, and you can then try to predict how the turnout's going to be. It's a lot harder in New York.
So a couple things before I let go of this bone here. And this is the poll, 49% to 44% with Delgado. A month ago, Faso was leading 48% to 47%. Still close, but certainly.
1 point. But Diane Neal, was that, that's her name, right?
Right.
Had 5 points or 6 points.
That was
in that
another
poll.
Not in this poll.
Okay.
Not in this particular poll.
So that's
poll.
A 7 point swing for Delgado
yeah.
in a month.
Well, right. What's big. The margin of error?
That's
on
significant.
The poll, did they tell you?
So,
4 or 5 usually.
I think it's 3.8, it was my understanding. Because I just looked that up and then I quickly forgot about it.
So do you think that when a poll comes out like this, like the Monmouth poll?
5.1, I'm sorry.
Do you think when the Monmouth poll comes out and shows Delgado leading, that that's good for Delgado or bad for Delgado?
Good. People want to vote with the winner, I think.
Well, I'm also
a week out.
I mean, there's still a lot of negative ads out there on both sides, and
boy, are there ever.
Yeah,
and
you know who's making a lot of money is the TV stations, but the. But it could embolden the Faso people to get the vote out. Now, this is a district where it's like a third are Democrat, a third are registered Republicans, and a third are not in either political party, and that is going to be the decider.
So now that you've raised it, Mike, I'm sorry, I don't mean to stick a sharp knife into your side, but you say that the
very vivid, wasn't it?
The TV stations are making a lot of money. There were days in the old days when newspapers used to make a lot of money around now. Is that gone for ever?
You don't see, man. You see local political ads. You don't really see like big, large ads. You know, for candidates.
It's more the mailings right?
Yeah, mailings, direct mail. But TV, you know, you can pinpoint a certain demographic on which since TV is now cable, and you can know who the audience is, et cetera.
I was just reading my copy of the New Yorker. On my iPad, minding my own business, and I turn from page 36 to page 37 to look at the cartoon, and all of a sudden, this big, huge ad just smashed onto my screen, and there I was watching a Faso ad.
And, wow. You know, and those ads do not educate the electorate at all. It doesn't give you any insight into their issues. It's fluff. It's rhetoric. It's useless.
But does it work?
Right. Sadly, it does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way,
well, I mean, I'm sorry, but I mean,
by the way, a newspaper will give you all that kind of information.
But does it work? If this race has turned by seven, let's take a snap. They say a poll is a snapshot, right? So if we say right now that Delgado has increased by 7 points, the ads that have been running by the NRCC regarding Delgado, and then I would say racist ads that are running. Does that have a? I mean, it does that factor into it? And I don't know how it can't.
Yeah, right, Ben. And the issue will be whether that turns people off, turns them off, and motivates them to go out and vote for his opponent, or whether it emboldens people to go out and vote for the candidate who's being promoted by those ads that you know many independent people have regarded as racist.
Yeah, but some things you don't tell anybody. When you're being appealed to by ads like that,
right.
You know, you don't tell your mother and you don't tell your grandmother, you know, that somebody has put out a scurrilous racist ad out there. And it appeals to you in terms of don't let those foreigners in that kind of thing.
I mean, I think that this is all part of the things that we were talking about before. So why do people follow conspiracy theories? Why do people enjoy watching cable TV outlets where there's just screaming and yelling from one ideological perspective or another? Why are people swayed by these ridiculous, and that's probably the best word for them, TV ads? I mean, if you're making your decision about a major vote based on a TV ad, there's a deeper issue.
But people do make up their minds.
Right, I'm saying. So this is a deeper problem.
Yeah, sure.
That is not just the function of who's the president right now. This is a much more longstanding and I would say very worrisome problem for
and
the,
all
for the
of
country.
The all of the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that are raised by political campaigns, the vast majority, 75% or 80%, are spent on television ads. And I've watched all of the Faso Delgado ads. I think that they combined create a lot of noise. None of them really stood out to be something that would move me. I saw one against Ted Cruz where the guy's talking about the White Castle burger, saying, Ted, there's no White Castle within 500 miles of Texas. Yeah. That ad, if you have a chance to watch it, is really memorable and moved me. The ones that I've seen for Faso Delgado, they kind of seem like a lot of noise. And it's a lot on evening news, it's wall to wall.
Boy, is it.
Well, we were talking about turnout. I was just going to mention that. Tuesday, November 6th, according to the 10-day outlook on weather.com, is supposed to be partly cloudy, mid-50s, and a very slight chance of rain. So what will that mean for turnout?
Good for the Democrats.
Okay.
Well, you know.
It all gets down to that, right? Down to the weather forecast.
It's important. It's very, very,
I know,
very
I know
important.
It's important. Yeah. I know it's important.
What party doesn't like rain? Is it the...
Well, it depends whether your assumption is that if it rains, there are some people who will stay home because it's too difficult to get out. And that's why I quipped, good for the Democrats.
Are you suggesting that there's more wimps among the Democrats than
no,
Republicans?
No, I'm suggesting it's tougher for old people and for people who are flipping hamburgers somewhere to get away under certain circumstances.
Or if you're dragging a baby to the polls, you don't want to bring the baby out in the cold rain. Yeah.
Bring an umbrella.
Yeah.
Yeah, there really should be no excuse. Maybe if you have a death in the family or broke a leg in the hospital, even then. No excuses here.
So what did you say your percentage of voting for to that pollster who called you?
Oh, I said 10.
10.
And
10
you know,
chances
and
out
the
of
other
10.
Thing that the pollster interestingly asked was, had I seen a Facebook ad for either of the candidates? He asked about all the media, TV ads, mailers. They never asked about a newspaper ad, which broke my heart.
Mine too.
Did you ask them? Did
no,
you say,
I don't,
hey,
I don't like to argue with the, you know, they're usually just kids or, you right. know, I don't like to give them a hard time unless they're trying to sell me something.
Then all bets are off.
I just hang up the phone.
All right, let's go to some other issues here before we wrap up this morning. Let's talk about the troops to the border. So 5,200 troops going to be sent to the border in an election season response to migrants. We touched on this, but not very much. More than 5,000 active duty military troops will deploy to the southern border by the end of this week, according to Defense Department officials. An escalation of a midterm election show of force against a caravan of Central American migrants that President Trump has characterized as an invasion of our country. We believe that the caravan, which was somewhere around 6,000 to 7,000 people, is now less than 3,500 people and is weeks away from reaching the United States. So as the 3,000 people march to the border, we now will have over 5,000 active military troops greeting them.
And we have an intervening variable, as you political scientists say, which is the Mexican government offering them
asylum.
Asylum.
And schooling and job training.
Right.
And a place to live.
And why are they doing that again?
Because it's the right thing to do?
No.
They're probably under pressure from the United States to do it, I guess.
Or because they have enough trouble with the United States and they say this is a good way.
Yeah. And they're also trying to keep them in provinces that are less populated where they need workers and they have the – right.
But I think to use the U.S. military as part of a publicity stunt is really outrageous.
But will it work?
It probably
Never
will
mind
work.
That.
And, you know, back to our conversation about these congressional races. So to think that we have the military deployed in places in harm's way as we speak, And how much is that really coming up in these congressional races? We had a panel last night at Bard on the conflict in Syria. We have troops in Syria deployed definitely in harm's way. What are they doing there? How long will they be there? What is their role there? Or in Afghanistan, where we've been at war for 17 years. I don't hear this coming up at all. And yet, on the front pages of the newspapers, it's this publicity stunt on the border. It really is outrageous.
And you got to wonder what the soldiers who are going to be deployed to the southern border, how they feel. They signed up to serve their country, and now they're going to go down and become a wall on the Mexican border. It doesn't seem like great service.
Well, and you wonder just how thought out it is. Because Mattis had, 800 troops? Am I right on that, Mike? 800 troops last week that he announced. So
how much do you need?
Well, right. And what brought the number to 5,000? I mean, is that arbitrary?
That shows strength, Joe. That shows power. It shows the president using his executive authority against what he calls invaders, these men, women, and children pushing strollers, elderly people
right.
who want to get reunited with their family that moved to the
a
U.S.
A national emergency.
It certainly is affecting the midterms. I heard on my way in on NPR, Claire McCaskill's running an ad saying, no one is tougher on the border than me and Donald Trump. So while Trump hurts in New York, Trump helps, I think, in places like Missouri.
All right, we have a couple letters. We'll go to those.
Here we go. Alan, having been a community college student not long ago, I can tell you that many of my fellow students were working, and some were also parents, so it is not surprising that they have no time to understand politics. Also, many do not understand how the system affects them and that it can be changed. Steep uphill battle, and that's from Maureen. Anybody? No. Okay, and Caroline says, Fox is not news. They are a propaganda network. You cannot equate them to other networks. Jeannie says, Fox versus the media, 30 years of conspiracies from Fox is not the same as 2 years of any media, quote, resistance. False equivalency strikes again. And Maureen says, JP has a point. I agree with JP that the cable networks have contributed to the toxic atmosphere. It's not the content that is upsetting me on MSNBC, but the tone of agitation. I always feel calmer when I hear NPR or WAMC, and I learn more. Also, I heard the most hateful right-wing commercial on MSNBC right after a sensible news program. I was shocked at the cynicism of the owners of the network. It's about profit. Well, that said, Trump is causing all the hate with his vitriol. Media reacts. And Jamie says, Trump and Israel, do not make the mistake of believing Trump has a cohesive position on the Jewish people in Israel. There they are, the defenders of everything America. Here they are, the agents of Satan bent on destroying the fabric of America. I don't quite get that one. Anybody else? No.
I don't know, but I'm always good for Agent of Satan to be referenced.
Dan says,
especially right before Halloween.
Dan says, an alternative. Dear panel, in response to Joe's emphatic, what is the alternative to so much coverage of Trump? How about less griping about how bad Trump is and less overanalyzing Trump and more about what people can do to combat trends that are dangerous to our country? Question mark. And John says,
Well, go ahead.
John says, what other options are there? Good morning, Joe, and wonderful panel. I agree with your esteemed colleague from the Empire Report. Almost daily Facebook predictive analytics sends me a statement from Bernie Sanders where he calmly and compassionately responds to the Trump atrocity of the day. If network news broadcasts that instead of Trump, tweets, conditions would improve.
But, you know, I think JP has another good point, too, and that is people can control what information they're taking in. People can be in charge of what they're reading, what they're viewing. They don't have to spend the entire day on Facebook or watching cable news. And it's each citizen's responsibility to just sort their way through the information. I mean, in the end, it's their responsibility.
As long as it includes WAMC, I don't care.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of people just enjoy it. They enjoy the antagonism. They like the fights. And for them, again, it's a little bit like worldwide wrestling.
That's a lot like that, yes.
Yeah. And the people enjoy it.
Yeah. All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody, Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, J.P. Miller, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain. Thank you all. Appreciate you being here. Very nice.
Tomorrow, we're going to have a special guest. Linda Ellerbee is going to be on the show.
Cool.
We're very excited to have Linda Ellerbee on joining us on the panel. And we're going to continue our program right after this.